It's my pleasure to introduce Father Joe Creedon. I really don't know much about him. I was going to read his bio when I got here, and like most of you, couldn't connect to Wi-Fi and read everything. If you're going to make comments about the conference, there's two things I request you put down: available Wi-Fi and warmer temperatures in all the rooms. Yes. So cold. So I'm going to let Father Joe introduce himself. I know he's been a longtime participant here at ICSC and is very popular with the Rhode Island crowd and all that have ever heard him speak before. So without further ado, Father Joe Creedon.
Thank you. Usually when you get introduced, when they get all done, I think there's another speaker that they must be introducing because it doesn't sound like me. Now, I hope this works. I paid the $15 extra, broke my heart to do it, but if it works, it's fine, and if it doesn't, I'll cry. It'll just take a second, and you'll know why in a minute. Yeah. Not going to work. Oh, maybe. Saints go marching. Now, since it was in New Orleans, and since the theme was called to be saints, and since when the saints come marching in is associated with New Orleans, usually with funerals, but I thought it could be used for the living, so I thought that would be a good way to start off. The title of the talk is When the Saints Come Marching In, A Reflection on Stewardship. There is a concept that was restored at the Second Vatican Council, but it certainly is not new to the Roman Catholic Church, and that is the universal call to holiness. When you download it, I gave you a whole bunch of quotes from contemporary popes, and I'm going to read two of them to you. One is John Paul II in Christi Fidelis Laici. Everyone in the church, precisely because they are members, receive and thereby share in the common vocation of holiness, in the fullness of this title, and on an equal par with all other members of the church, the lay faithful are called to holiness. Then he quotes the Second Vatican Council, all the faithful of Christ, of whatever rank or status, are called to the fullness of Christian life and to the perfection of charity. All of us. Somewhere we lost sight of that. All of us. And Pope Francis in Gaudete Exaltate, I don't know if you know about Vatican documents, they're always in Latin, but the first two words tell you what it's about. So Pope John, John Paul II was the Christian faithful laity, and this is to rejoice and proclaim. Do not be afraid of holiness. It will take away none of your energy, vitality, or joy. On the contrary, you will become what the Father had in mind when he created you, and you will be faithful to your deepest self. To depend on God sets us free from every form of enslavement and leads us to recognize our great dignity. Those are important. And even before the Second Vatican Council, Yves Congar, the Dominican, was very active in writing about the laity, and he was suppressed because of it. He was suppressed by Pius XII. And it was John the 23rd who invited Congar to be a paritas, an expert, at the Second Vatican Council that resurrected his career. And even before that, Jose Maria Escriva, the founder of Opus Dei, the whole foundation of Opus Dei is the universal call to holiness of all the baptized. And it goes back to the Gospels, to Matthew 5:48, a quote that probably when you hear it, like me, makes my skin crawl. Okay? So be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. I always feel like I can't do that. But God is perfectly God, but I only have to be perfectly me. And you only have to be perfectly you. And that's who we become when we're baptized. So I think what we need to do is to remember the universal call to holiness. Has the time finally come for the church we love to live out this universal call to holiness? Not just write about it, not just talk about it, but to actually live it. Because I think there's a lot we have to do to make all of us realize that we're called to holiness. In the past, is it past time for the laity to take their rightful place in the mission and ministry of the church? And the answer is clearly yes. But there are some people who stand in the way. Clerics stand in the way. Clericalism is a, Pope Francis talks about clericalism all the time. The scourge of clericalism. I often say, baptism is frequently called the order of the faithful. And then there's holy orders. Holy orders exist to serve those in the order of the faithful. Unfortunately, we've got it the other way around. And that causes a lot of problems. Now, at Mass, there's something, pray that this sacrifice might be acceptable to God, our Almighty Father. And what's the response? May the Lord accept the sacrifice at your hands. Time out. Why don't we say our hands? Did you ever hear of the common priesthood of the faithful? Yeah. But here's the deal. The priest used to be called the celebrant. When I go around now in retirement,
would you please stand and greet the celebrant, Father Creedon?
And I usually get to the front and say, I am not the celebrant, I'm the presider. We are the celebrants. As long as it's at my hands, you can not pay attention. But if it's at our hands, then we have a vested interest. Then we own it. Now, I don't expect the church anytime soon to say, we found a mistake in the Mass, and we're going to ask people to say at our hands. But I don't think lightning will strike. Try it out at tonight's Mass. Just see, don't say it too loud. The people around you might get a little nervous. There's always somebody from the liturgy police who's going to turn you in. But anytime, I always say at our hands. But once again, I'm ordained. I can say that, you know. But no, we're baptized. We're the baptized. So it's at our hands. And I think if we can kind of get used to that. Now, you have to understand, and this has been a pet peeve of mine for some time. The laity, do you know how the laity used to be defined before the Second Vatican Council? all those people who weren't clerics. Well, now that's a great way to be defined, isn't it? Right away, you're put in your place. But no. And clericalism is insidious. There are plenty of seats, by the way, for the people who are standing. So if you got a seat next to you, just put your hand up. And when I was first made pastor of Christ the King Parish in Kingston, where I was pastor for 31 years, I would go to the opening of an envelope. I thought that was my job. So any committee meeting, any gathering, I would show up for. And not just a cuckoo clock, you know, beep, beep, in and out. No, I'd stay for the whole thing. But I was at a religious formation committee meeting one night, and back then, this is how long ago it was, we had beepers for the hospital. And it was my night to cover the hospital. And so the religious ed committee meeting was going on, and my beeper went off. So I got up and went into the office and made a call. Okay, lady need to be anointed. So I said to the people, see ya. And I went down and took care of anointing the lady. The next day, the religious ed director said, do you want to know what happened after you left? I said, please. Well, she started and she went and she went and she went and she went. I said, when did all that come up? Why did that happen? He said, because you left. They were more free to speak their mind without me there than they were with me there. Important lesson. Every now and again, skip meetings. Because it wasn't my intention to suppress their freedom, but that's what was happening. That's how insidious clericalism can be. Austin Everling, I can never pronounce his name correctly. He's the biographer of Pope Francis. He's an English guy. He's in the Tablet magazine that comes out of London frequently. Fascinating, fascinating kind of guy. The time has come for Christianity to transcend itself, to move out beyond its existing mental, institutional, and clerical boundaries, to ask how the Spirit is acting, and to find a new cultural home. See, we are so used to, let's keep things the way they are. Look at all the difficulty, look at all the flack that Pope Francis is getting because he's trying to introduce a thing called synodality. And basically what synodality is all about is listening, gathering people together and asking them to speak their mind. What a radical thought. And not just have bishops and priests, have laymen and laywomen. And let them speak their mind. That's the only way we're going to find out. The call to holiness and the spirituality of stewardship can work together. Because stewardship is all about recognizing our gifts. And one of our gifts is that we are the baptized. That's who we are. And unfortunately, for too long, we've been suppressed. Now, just a brief primer on stewardship. I've been to a number of talks, and very little mention is made of the Bishop's Pastoral Letter from 1991. If you haven't read it, please buy a copy and read it. It's one of the best documents the bishops have ever put out, and it's in English. It's actually in English that we can understand. They don't use a lot of technical terms. But in that document, they boil stewardship down to four things, okay? You receive God's gifts gratefully. You develop them responsibly. You share them lovingly in justice with others. And you make a return with increase to God. It's real simple. That's what it's all about. But sometimes we forget about that. And we forget that stewardship is a spirituality. Stewardship is an attitude. It's not a program. Programs come and go. It's a spirituality. It's all about developing the attitude of gratitude. And once somebody, Lisa Anslinger, gave me a copy of a recent book, which I wrote something in months and months ago, and I forgot I had written it even. And I was reading it last night, and I started off by saying, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If you're a steward, everything looks like a gift or an opportunity. And that's what we need to rediscover. And once you do that, you find stewardship references, or at least I find stewardship references, in the most remarkable of places. Arnold Palmer. Okay? I'm a golf fanatic. I don't hope for things, or rather, I don't hope for certain things to happen to me. To hope is to wait for things to come to you. To dream is to be part of the process of setting goals and striving for them. That's what stewardship is all about. It's setting goals to see everything as a gift from God, and then striving to deepen our appreciation of that in our heart. Achieve, you must first dream before anything can happen. If you ever, no, not if you ever, when you read the Bible, realize how often God works when people are asleep or in deep prayer. You know, I'm sure Mary said to Joseph, stop taking naps. I'm tired of moving to Egypt. You know, I'm tired of all this. But why? Because when we're asleep and when we dream, our imagination is vivid. You know, if you try and explain your dreams to someone, they look at you very, very strangely. And we look at ourselves very, very strangely. But it's all about attitude. There's a book called Letters to My Son by Kent Newbird. And one of my favorite quotes is in that book. If we don't offer ourselves to the unknown, our senses dull. Our world becomes small and we lose our sense of wonder. Our eyes don't lift to the horizon. Our ears don't hear the sounds around us. The edge is off of experience. And we pass our days in a routine that is both comfortable and limiting. We wake up one day to find that we have lost our dreams to protect our days. We've all been there. The dream of what we were going to do and what we have finally settled for. So, the call to holiness and spirituality of stewardship can make the universal call to holiness, I think, come alive. What's really important is our point of view. And I forget where I came across this story recently, but I just loved it. Two guys are out camping. It's the middle of the night. They're both awake, but they don't want to say anything because they're afraid the other person might be asleep. But then finally they realize they're both awake, and one guy says, Jim, what are you thinking about? He says, well, Pat, I'm looking up at the sky. I see the stars. I see how bright they are. I'm reminded of nature. How lucky are we to be on this trip, that God has given us this beauty of creation. And I just feel small in front of all that wonder. And Jim says, Pat, what are you thinking about? He said, I'm wondering who stole our tent. It's all about our point of view. You know the old saying, are you an optimist or a pessimist? Is the glass half full or the glass half empty? Put a flower in it and the question goes away. It's all about focus. So, for too long, I think, we've had the wrong focus on our church. We focus on shrinking communities, closing parishes, too many priests retiring or dying, not enough priests ordained to take their place, the lingering effects of COVID-19, the never-ending scandal of the sexual abuse crisis. That's where we focus. Why don't we focus differently? How about we focus on the beauty of the liturgy? How about we focus on deepening our appreciation of the Eucharist? How about if we focus on the fact that Eucharist is a verb, not just a noun? And too often we treat Eucharist as a noun. It's the host. It's benediction. It's adoration. And those are all good things. But they are all the product of a verb. A gathering, a confessing, a praising, a listening, an offering, a praying, a transforming, a receiving, being blessed, and being sent. That's what we have to focus on. And I think part of the problem is we all know what the problems are, but we want someone else to do the work. Now, I haven't been eavesdropping on any of your conversations, but why doesn't the pastor fill in the blank? Why doesn't the bishop fill in the blank? Why doesn't the Pope fill in the blank? Why don't I fill in the blank? Because we want them to do the work. We just want the benefits. And I think that's a problem. I remember I was my study fellowship in the year 1981. I was out at the Menninger Foundation, which was then located in Topeka, Kansas. And I was a fellow of psychiatry and religion. And my mother always said, when you tell that story, please, because the Menninger Foundation is a psychiatric hospital, make sure you tell people you were there on a fellowship. Mothers are very good about things like that. But there was a guy, Father Ed Hayes, who founded the Shantavanam House of Prayer in Easton, Kansas. And Ed Hayes, prolific author, good artist, just a really talented guy. And he was giving a parish mission at Most Pure Heart of Mary in Topeka, Kansas, where I was in residence. And we were up one night after the mission. I think it may have been St. Patrick's night. And I think alcoholic beverages may have been involved. I'm not entirely sure in my memory on that. But he and I got into a discussion, and he was saying, if something's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. And I was, no. If something's worth doing, it's worth doing right. And we went back and forth. But finally, it dawned on me. I remember when my oldest niece was born, and my brother Jerry, who was, believe me, the smartest of the Creedon boys, when we had our conversations, who's second smartest? I mean, we just conceded first place to my brother Jerry. He was off the charts bright. But he was sitting on the couch with his niece, Kathy, on his knee. And this man with a doctorate in electrical engineering, who ended up running Langley Research Center for NASA, was going, guh-guh-guh. And I'm on the other side of the room saying, what is wrong with this picture? This doesn't make any sense. But you know what dawned on me? If my mother and father hadn't picked up Jerry, and picked up Bill and me and my brother Mike, and said those profound words, guga, I'd have never learned how to speak English. If something's worth doing, it's worth doing poorly. And by doing it poorly, we improve and we learn how to do it better. Imagine how many things have not been achieved because people were afraid they might fail doing it. And that affects our parishes, I think, something awful. We need to change our focus when it comes to the universal call of holiness. The universal church is a very important issue, and Pope Francis is very important. But I'd have to say that that doesn't affect my life very much, and it doesn't affect your lives very much. It's part of the pyramid. It's part of the power structure. It's there. But anything that happens in Rome doesn't really cramp my style any. And you can focus on the diocese if you want, but the diocese doesn't really affect our being believers, I don't think. You can focus on the parish and what some people are doing wrong, if that's your thing. Or you can focus on the 9:30 Mass where you go and focus on what can you do to make that worship more vibrant. So when we start to change the focus, I think we'll see things starting to change. I love to tell this story. A grandmother at Christ the King Parish when I was there brought her granddaughter to church, and the granddaughter wasn't too used to church, and I was preaching, and I took my watch off, and I put it up on the podium. Well, the granddaughter had been saying to her grandmother, why are those windows stained, and so she told her about stained glass windows, and why were there candles, and she told her about the candles. Why is it? And told her, then she said, what does it mean when Father Creedon takes his watch off and puts it on the podium? And she said, absolutely nothing. So, I think what we need to focus on is the fact that we are called to be seekers, not settlers. And too many times, we have settled. We've settled for what is, rather than what could be. We wake up one day to see we've lost our dreams to save our days. So we need to be seekers. Anthony DeMello, the Jesuit, who tried his best to build a bridge between the religions of the East and the West, fascinating guy. If you've never read any of Anthony DeMello, he has lots of wonderful little stories, little parables that just they're filled with wisdom. And one of my favorite ones goes like this. I used to be stone deaf. I saw people get up going through wild gyrations. They called it dancing. I thought it foolish until one day I heard the music. Think about that. If you can't hear the music, dancing doesn't make any sense. And so I think sometimes we're deaf to the call of God. I think sometimes we're deaf to stewardship. I think sometimes we're afraid people are going to think we're crazy. Because if we really live the gospel, we're going to stand out against the culture in which we live. I sometimes say mass for the Christian brothers in their retirement home. And there was a brother Brendan from Africa. He was a character and a half. And I gave a homily one day and I said, has anybody told you you were crazy because of what you believe? And I just left it there. And at the sign of peace, I went down and I said, Brendan, peace be with you. He said, you know, you're crazy. but that's a compliment. That's a compliment, and we need to do that. You're here at this conference to learn the dance called stewardship. In order to learn the dance called stewardship, you have to hear the music. You have to hear the call of God. You have to hear the scriptures. You have to remember what baptism is all about. This whole synodal thing that Pope Francis is doing, he's trying to introduce what requires that we become better listeners. I think sometimes we've just given up listening, and I think that's at our own demise. We need to create spaces in our parishes where there is the free exchange of ideas. And if that means my missing a meeting, that means my missing a meeting. And if that means you go to a meeting and somehow you find the courage to speak up where previously you'd be afraid to, because what's Mrs. McGillicuddy going to think about me? So we have to find a way to be better listeners, and we have to find a way to get the courage to speak our mind to the power that sometimes doesn't want to hear us. Remember when we landed on the moon? Houston, we have a problem. Rome, we have a problem. That's a waste of time. We, the saints, have the problem. And we have to find a way to address it and to help our church become more vibrant. Richard Galliardez, a lay theologian, who unfortunately died recently at a very young age of pancreatic cancer. He had dedicated his whole life to ecclesiology and especially understanding the church since the Second Vatican Council. I know it's here. In his book, The Church in the Making, in the second chapter of the Constitution on the Church in the World, we have neither a theology of the laity nor a theology of the clergy, but rather a theology of the Christian faithful, the Christa Fideles, the same word that John Paul II used, equal in dignity, called to a common discipleship through baptism. That's what we need to focus on. The Lay-Centered Church by Leonard Doonan. Lay persons do not belong to the church, nor do they have a role in the church. Rather, through baptism, the laity is the church. In the Decree on Christian Missionary Activity, number 21 in Ad Gentes, the participants stated, "The church is not truly established, nor does it fully live, nor is the church a perfect sign of Christ among the people, unless there exists a laity worthy of the name, working alongside the hierarchy, for the gospel cannot be deeply imprinted on the mentality, life, and work of any people without the presence of active lay people." It's in the documents. What we got to do is get it into the church. And I think that's the challenge. In life, we learn through mentors. I'm here today, and I'm giving this talk, because of some people that you've never met, but they had a deep, profound influence on who I am. Monsignor Arthur Sullivan was the rector of the seminary when I was a young seminarian, a man I was deeply afraid of until after I was ordained. Monsignor Paul Riedel, who was the rector of the American College in Louvain, Belgium, wonderful, gentle man. Had difficulty making decisions, frustrated me no end, because I don't like people who can't make decisions. But I learned to love that man. Why? Because he treated people with dignity. And that's really important. Henry Wagnone, Canon Wagnone, taught me canon law. Hank the Tank. Hank the Tank weighed about 400 pounds. He was a brilliant, brilliant teacher. And he gave me a love for canon law. Louis Jansons taught moral theology. That man read Vatican documents and saw things that no one else saw and helped set me free. Sister Dominica, the principal of my grammar school, who tricked me into the seminary. Martha Capaldi, who was a pastoral minister in a neighboring parish. Wonderful, kind, gentle person, religious education, funeral ministry. Nancy Drennan, my own pastoral associate, first woman priest I ever knew. She didn't let the church tell her what she could and couldn't do. She wouldn't even let me do that. Harry and Kitty Creedon, my mom and dad. They weren't your typical church people. Went to Mass every Sunday. My mother was not in the Rosary Altar Society. My father was a member of the Holy Name, and he went to the breakfast once a year, but he never went to a meeting. A nurse at Kent County Hospital, when I was a junior in college, we had a pick between teaching CCD in a local parish, visiting the hospital, or going to the state mental hospital. And I always had a deathly fear of hospitals. So I said, if I'm going to be a priest, I got to learn how to go to hospitals. So I went, and I forget this nurse's name, but I remember her all the time. My second week going there, she said, "Mrs. Alvarez in 212 wants to talk to you again." I said, "Who's Mrs. Alvarez?" She grabbed me by the suit coat, put me up against the wall. And she said, "If you're coming here for your ego, stay home. You had a conversation with her last week. You have an obligation to remember her name, remember what you talk about, and if you don't do that, get out of ministry." And she was absolutely correct. She was absolutely correct. And so that's who we learn from. Everyone has a story to tell. Remember their name. Listen well. Listen. Digest. And act. Now, when it comes to who we are, one of my favorite stories, and the people of Christ the King would say, any story you tell is your favorite story, but It's called the Irish Farmhouse. And back before the Celtic Tiger, when things were tough in Ireland, a lot of homes and farms were abandoned. And outside this village, there was such an abandoned farmhouse and home. And then one day, somebody bought the property, and the next thing you know, the stone walls had been fixed, the thatched roof was repaired, the cottage had a fresh coat of whitewash, there was peat burning in the fireplace, there were plants and cattle, and the place had come alive. But back in the town, everybody noticed, whoever it was who owned the place didn't go to church. So they said to the pastor, and pastors always get the best jobs, we want you to find out why that person doesn't go to church. So on a given day, the pastor drove out, went, knocked on the door, was greeted warmly by the new owner, sat down, had the cup of tea, the obligatory cup of tea in Ireland, and finally the pastor went for the kill. He said, I love what you and God have done with this place. The guy took a sip of tea and he says, Father, you remember what it looked like when God had it by himself? That is so contrary to the gift of stewardship, that everything we have is a gift from God. His opportunity to buy that was a gift. His opportunity to improve that was a gift. When things go well, we take the credit. When things go wrong, we blame God. Just read your insurance policy. An act of God is never a good thing on your insurance policy. There's only two kinds of people in the world. There's sailboat people and there's rowboat people. I got this from a Canadian mystery writer, and I forgot his name. He said rowboat people. I added the sailboat people. But in a rowboat, what happens? You go forward looking backwards. So where is your focus? On the past. You're not really paying a whole lot of attention to where you're going. In a sailboat, however, you go forward, looking forward, and you know the power that moves you is not your own. You have to catch the breath of God in your sail. And sometimes it's smooth sailing, and sometimes you have to tack. But you always have to go forward. And that's what stewardship, I think, helps us do in a parish. Tip O'Neill, the famous politician from Massachusetts, Speaker of the House, used to have a saying, all politics are local politics. If I can cheat on that just a bit, all church is local church. And that's what we have to do. When we have vibrant parishes, we'll have vibrant dioceses. And when we have vibrant dioceses, we'll have vibrant national churches. And when we have vibrant national churches, we'll have a vibrant universal church. It's not trickle down. It's witness up. And that's what I think we have to work at. If we keep waiting for it to be the other way around, it's not going to happen. May stewardship be your sail and not your anchor. Thank you. Now, if you have questions, either about the talk or the stock market or whatever, our moderator will go around, and you have to speak into the microphone so that it can be recorded, because otherwise if I hear you and somebody buys the tape, they're going to think, so if you have a question, put your hand up and the moderator will find you.
Don't be shy.
Father, it seems as though if this room was just filled, and I'm sure there's priests and clergy in here, but this room should be full of priests hearing this message about clericalism, and what can we do to take back to our parishes, and if we do have opportunities in our parish to have priests embolden and encourage the laity. How do we do it?
Okay. The thing I've always found amazing is you would want other priests to be in here so that I could tell them. Okay. Which I would point out was one of my points. But the thing I don't understand It's a numbers thing. There's a whole lot more of you than there are of us. How has that worked? Some of it has been inbred. Some of it is centuries of wanting the people to be passive. We forget that before the Second Vatican Council, you couldn't even come into the sanctuary. There was a rail and a rope. That was the Holy of Holies. So progress has been made, and I think priests put their pants on one leg at a time, just like everybody else. I think I have a thing that I used to have with parishioners and sometimes with staff members called the Come to Jesus Talk. And that's when you put your arm around somebody and you take a little trip around the parking lot and you have to say, you know, I think we need to take a look at some things. If you say, you know, Father, and it's very important to make I statements and not you statements. You statements always come at the end of a pointed finger, and that always starts a fight. But if you can say to somebody, I was offended by the way you rejected what I had to say. So I just want you to know I'm offended. You're not looking for him to change. You're giving him information that hopefully will help him change. I feel much better when you walk with me rather than walk in front of me. So just a bunch of I statements. And, you know, I think we're in this together. I think we want this community to be vibrant and active. I know we have different ways of approaching it. But I think there's a little bit of truth in your way, and I hope you can see that there's a little bit of truth in my way, and somehow we can find a way to surface that. Those kinds of things, I think, can help. So thank you very much, Sharon, for that question.
I'm Deacon Siegfried from the Diocese of Charlotte, and We kind of have a trend in our diocese where a lot of the new priests are going pre-Vatican II and going towards, you know, like a lot of the stuff pre-Vatican and are kind of against the lay people getting involved and stuff. What can we do to work around that?
Pray for him. No, I think that's pretty much universal in the United States. I think a lot of the young guys are very, very conservative, but they've been sent by bishops to seminaries that are very, very conservative, and that's what they want. The thing that nobody talks about is that half of them leave before they're ordained 10 years, because what they want and the pedestal they want to stand on, the laity have decided they're not bringing back. And so they've either got to change and adapt, or they're going to get washed out. Now, nobody wants anybody to be washed out of the priesthood. And I think a lot of times they just need somebody to invite them to dinner. Not to say, well, Bobby got you here, Father. We're going to straighten you out. No. Let them see your family. Let them see what your faith is like. And invite him to loosen up a little bit, okay? Because everybody likes to succeed. They all want to be liked. That Monsignor Arthur Sullivan that I mentioned, my mother used to have a great description of him. He's trying to be human and nobody ever taught him how, you know? And to a certain extent, that was true. He was a wonderful, wonderful man. But he finally learned how to be a human being. So I think if we treat them as brothers, if we treat them as part of the faithful, the order of the faithful, the baptized, you know, Father, we're in this together. Sometimes I don't get the feeling that you see that. And I hope I can convince you of that. Those kind of things. But it's a challenge. I had one of the young guys. He said to me, we're going to win because you're going to die. I said, oh. I said, well, my dad lived to 93, so you're not getting rid of me that easily, but we'll see what happens. And there's a certain arrogance in that. But
Father, I want to just thank you for bringing up the process during meetings, that how important it is to listen. Because in this society now where, you know, everything is immediate and, you know, everybody holds a phone, we listen to wait for the breath to stop in the other person so we can jump in there and give our own ideas. I think if you truly develop a charism for listening, it means that you're able to receive. And when you can receive, I think you also can develop compassion in listening to what perhaps that person is saying underneath. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why some of our meetings are not as successful, because we're all waiting to push our own agenda instead of truly listening. And then that includes young pastors and young priests, and whether it's a young RCIA coordinator or someone first time on the job, we're always ready to correct and tell them what's wrong as opposed to listening and receiving them.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for that. I have some books up here that will be for sale afterwards, Stewardship of Life-Giving Spirituality. But in the book, there's a story of my father. Now, my father was not a man of many words, but when he spoke, we all listened. And he avoided church committees, and they were better off for it. But this priest invited him to, because my dad was a civil engineer, to sit on a committee. They were going to create communion stations, and so they went and they met, and it was A, B, and C, and everybody, there were six people on the committee, and everybody voted that B was the right thing to do, and so forth and so on. And about 2 or 3 weeks later, the phone rang at home. My father, well, my mother always answered the phone, but she said, it's for you. And so he got on the phone. It was the priest. And he said, Mr. Green, I just want to tell you, we're going with C. My father said, C? Everybody agreed that was the stupidest of the three. Why are you going with C? And finally, the priest made a fatal mistake. And he said, that's what's wrong with the church today. If people would just listen to the priest, there wouldn't be any problems. And my father said, Father, they ordained my boy Joe, and he got no smarter in the process. Now, my father was a totally non-tactile Irishman. I got right up in the chair and hugged him. I said, thank you for that story. Thank you for that story.
Again, thank you, Father Joe, for your, I use the word refreshing insights. They're not new. I've been listening to you for a while, but thank you. They're new enough, and they should get new every day. And I want to try to say this right, because it's been very helpful to me. I've been a priest for over 40 years, a pastor, and I taught in the seminary. I was a spiritual director for about 10 years. And one of the things that most helped me in the last 20 years, I've worked in the healing ministry, inner healing. We've done retreats that have been double booked for years. So God is somehow using that. And what really helped me, and I hope it will help you as the laity, because if we're not working together, then we're not like working. It helped me when someone helped me to understand the power I had as a person. You see, it's not only the young priest, but it seems to be more the younger priest now. They only know or think their power is their priesthood or their collar. Many of them are young or younger. When I was ordained in 1983, my class was the oldest class. I was in my mid-30s, and I was the youngest one. More candidates today are a little younger, thank God. But they seem to think that their power is only in their ordination. So I would suggest, how do you work with the priest? Don't talk to him the way he talks to you. Talk to him in a way that you help him realize what his power is as a person, as a man, as a leader. And not just because he wears a collar. Now, there's a lot of insights there, and I've worked with a lot of wounded and troubled people in all these years. And I don't know where it comes from, but for my years, particularly in the last 30 as a pastor, I've always, only by the grace of God, talked about the love of God and mercy. And people say, well, and there was a certain bishop, who I won't name, he said, where do you get all that? And I think I said, Jesus? He didn't know what to say. Now, it might be, seem like a contradiction, because I'm the one standing here with a microphone, but I'm a pretty introverted person. So when a friend or two, one primarily, but others, spoke to me or engaged with me in a way, it helped me to realize who I am or who I could be as a person, as a believer, and as a leader in a Christian, in the church. Those are the people that I learned to listen to. But another person comes in, and there was a person at a previous parish, God bless him, he'd come every 3-4 months, he'd say, Father, you really, he'd give me, he was an idea guy. He had a lot of great ideas. And then he left. He said, well, you never take any of my ideas. Well, how many hands do you think I have? So if you can talk with the priest, even the young ones, I know it's hard, or the ones that aren't so young, talk to them in a way that you feel or perceive he'll be able to understand and hear. Because if you talk to him in the manner that he's talking to you, do it this way because I said, he's not going to listen and he's not going to learn anything. Mm-hmm. You're going to be frustrated and he's going to feel bigger. Try to empower him. Because although I learned some good things in the seminary, I didn't learn a lot about being human or an integrated person. A lot of that was on me as a person. So when you help a priest feel the empowerment of his person, that we all have a person and a personality and a temperament, if you help that priest understand himself, then he won't have to cling to his power and only operate through his collar.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for your mission and your ministry. Michael Crosby, many years ago, wrote a book called The Dysfunctional Church. And in that book, he has a great line. They only have power over you if you grant it to them. And I think we need to rediscover that in our church.
Anyone else? Final question? Yes, ma'am.
Father Creedon, do you believe there's a place, we talked about the church that the younger priests and a lot of the younger people are embracing today, that is more like the church that I grew up in kind of thing. Do you believe there's a place for that kind of church and the kind of church we're here hearing from you about and many of us embrace, for both of those to exist?
Thank you. Great question. I don't think rowboat people and sailboat people can be compatible. I think tradition is wonderful. I think it's important. I've been ordained 56 years. I've never said Mass in Latin. I know Latin. I know how to say Mass in Latin. I just couldn't think of a reason why I ever would. And I think sometimes, especially when Pope Benedict allowed the Latin without the bishop's permission, they did away with that because it was causing so much friction and lack of unity in the church. So I think there's plenty of room within the new ordo for there to be personal adjustments. I think guys can hold up the host longer if they want to, or genuflect more profoundly if they want to, and if that works for them, that's fine. I don't genuflect anymore because I'm afraid I won't be able to get up. So you have to make certain adaptations. But I think the church, there's a phrase that we've, ecclesia semper reformanda, the church is always reforming. And I think that we need to respect that. And sometimes I don't think some people do respect it. One last, if there is, or we can call it off.
I think we're good.
Good. Very good.